Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is J.B. Smoove. Heads up to listeners, there are a lot of expletives in this episode of Bullseye. So you are going to hear this sound a lot. A whole lot. Our apologies. We tried to slow him down, and it didn't work. J.B. Smoove is without a doubt one of the funniest people I have ever met, or for that matter, seen on screen. He's best known as Leon on Curb Your Enthusiasm, but it's also worth taking the time to see him in basically anything he has ever done. IMDb lists him with about 75 acting credits, and you know, it might be worth going through and watching every single one of them as soon as I'm done recording this episode. But even with all those credits, JB hits the road when he can to work on his stand-up. He's touring the country now. Here's a clip from his stand-up special on Comedy Central. This is how I do's it.
I played my first villain. Right? Did this movie, I played a villain. Something cool about being an evil. Wish I could do things at will. You know what I mean? Like, do things at will. Like, you know what I wish I could do? I wish I could just, like, pile drive somebody anytime I wanted to. You know what I mean? Yeah, I gave you a 5. You gave me change for a 1. Yeah. Yeah, looking at in that pile of ones, you'll see a 5. You know? No. It's a, no. Come on, dog. Come on, man. Take the pile of ones and get my change back. Okay. Oh, man, you a fool, man. If you don't get my change back, woo, you got me tripping up in here.
The unmistakable sound of J.B. Smoove delivering a pile drive.
Nothing better than a good pile drive.
Welcome to the show, J.B. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Hey, man, it's always fun. You know, I always call it channeling another man. Let's channel each other today.
Okay.
You know, because sometimes you got to feel a person. You got to get their tendencies. You got to feel the space around you, and you attach yourself to that.
Have you already checked in with me so far?
Oh, you did. After that, I came in the door.
Do you have insights already?
I see the beard. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? I see a style. I haven't noticed how you cross your leg.
Yeah.
See? Yeah, I'm a right over left man myself, see?
Yeah, I'm going left over right here.
No, you're left over right.
I've had some hip pain, so.
See, that goes back to when someone sees you and you say, my left or your left?
We're matching. We're like mirror men now.
We're mirror men.
Well, thank you for coming on the program. I mentioned
unless it's one of those two-way mirrors where they put in those old-time department stores. You know what I'm saying? If it's that kind of thing, but it's not that kind of thing right now. We are absolutely mirroring each other right now.
I mentioned.
Unless you want to steal some and put it in your boxes. And then you want to be a mirror and I'm just a security dude watching you from the other side. Huh?
Are we pitching a movie here?
No, I'm just pointing out little tendencies that people have to do. And one involves stealing through a two-way mirror.
So
do they even use two-way mirrors anymore?
I think they use them in consumer focus groups, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever been in one of those focus groups?
I did
where they
one
give
before.
You $50
I was
and
the
they
host.
Tell what do you think about these pants?
Hosted
you were
one
the before. Host for one?
I did one for Mountain Dew Whiteout.
Because here's the reason that I'm surprised by that. It's not that you had a white-collar professional job. I'm sure you had white-collar professional jobs before you were a stand-up comic. But the reason that I'm surprised is the job of that person who hosts the focus group is not to bias anyone in the room to like be a neutral party who people can be critical of the product to and feel comfortable being critical of the product to. They just kind of guide the conversation in a neutral way.
That's all it is.
I honestly have a hard time imagining you guiding any conversation in a neutral way.
I make the floor even and I go so deep that you don't see. People are not supposed to see JB.
Okay,
you can't see me. You can't see me. You can't feel me. At all. I gotta take you someplace else, a whole different place. Physically and my presence has got to be so obscured you can't see me.
So I mentioned this before we got started, but you were a guest once on the show before. You were a cast member of a show called Cedric the Entertainer Presents.
Oh, man.
Network sketch show. Mm-hmm. And I was in the middle of interviewing one of the writers as he was in the middle of directing a scene. I think he had to go check some blocking. And he handed the phone to you. And that guy, a very, very well-known comedy writer at the time, told me that he thought you were the funniest person in the world.
Oh, man.
And he didn't say that flippantly, and he didn't say it like as he handed the phone to you to explain why he was.
I love it.
I think I asked him who he thought was the funniest person in the world, and he said you.
I dig that.
You know, on the one hand, you were already a veteran performer. That was about 15 years ago.
15 years
ago. You're in your early 50s. But on the other hand, that was still relatively early in your career in terms of where you've gone since then. Did you feel like you were making it 15 and 20 years ago? Like, what constituted making it to you?
To me, what constituted... See, I'm a different animal. See, I'm very satisfied being, you know, B-level, because I feel like it allows me to do that a lot of major stars can't do. I can still get my RV.
Wait, do people prevent Brad Pitt from getting an RV?
This dude can't just get out and just walk into a grocery store or go and buy a candy bar without someone saying, "Oh my God, you're Brad Pitt." Well, even if somebody did recognize me, it's kind of, I can still walk away.
But Brad Pitt can go to Grand Tetons National Park in his Airstream, can't he?
I'm sure he can. But he's still Brad Pitt. Now, I use this analogy with Howard Stern. I was on Howard Stern's show. And I said, Howard, he talked about this kind of about the same thing. I said, man, see, you can't eat spaghetti on an open patio. And he said, what does that mean? It means you can't sit there as Howard Stern with a bowl of spaghetti, the mozzarella on top, maybe a little bit of ricotta, a little parmesan. You can't sit there and consciously eat that without the threat of your lips pulling together and pulling spaghetti in your mouth. Because they're going to see a photo of your in the paper. Because I'm not worried about someone taking a photo of me or videotaping me and I'm on TMZ, unbeknownst to me. See, that's how I measure your success, is what you can do that normal people do.
Was that a choice in your life? I mean, you have had as much success as a human being who is fourth on the call sheet can have.
Yes.
You have done everything you can do in comedy that's not with your name at the top of the bill. You certainly, as a stand-up comic, you tour and headline. But in most things, you've been second and third on the bill.
Yes, indeed.
And I wondered, because of how brilliantly funny you are, frankly, I wonder if JB at some point just decided I would rather get the jobs that where I know what I can do, I can come in and kill it.
There you go.
I don't have to carry the weight.
I don't got to do All I got to do is get in there. The reason, it's the same thing in sports. You get these basketball trades, people can't wait to trade deadline. Matter of fact, they should have trade deadlines in real life. You should be able to trade your dad in at the last minute. He lost his job. You want to get a dad who has a better job. And that's the same thing with being an actor. Your ass should be able to take whatever you can do and be the most beneficial part of a team. It includes movies, it includes TVs, directing, producing, whatever. I'm telling you, I turn down far more than I take, because I just feel like, If I can't show up there and give you 20% of what the you're looking for, I shouldn't be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other high points of your career. You wrote on Saturday Night Live for a few years.
Yes.
And when you wrote on Saturday Night Live, my understanding is that you went out to be a cast member.
Mm-hmm.
It came down to three. Two of them got cast and you didn't. Is that right?
That's right.
It was Finesse Mitchell, you, and who's the third person? Keenan Thompson. And thank you. And it must have been disappointing to get that close to to get that close to that point, and also to have it complicated by the fact that you're like that not only did 2 out of 3 get picked and you didn't make it, but also that there like was obviously unwritten rules about how many black guys could get picked. Like, not to put too fine a point on it,
right. I don't know. There's certain things that are needed in a certain time on a show like that. And I think that's whether you're black or whether you're white or whether you're, because I consider myself so many different things. I'm a big character, whether I'm white or black. I'm very physical, whether I'm white or black. I'm a scene stealer, whether I'm white or black. I'm so many things on so many levels. I've been doing it a long time, longer than anybody who I auditioned with for the show. So there's a few things in there. You know, they always say that, you know, we don't hire stars, we make stars. So I was already on stuff, did several things before I got there. But I'm also like this. I'm very conscious of who I am and what I do. So for me, it's always like, okay, I didn't make the show. But I always feel like you know of me now. So whether it's here, whether it's another producer who leaves the show or whatever, my phone gonna ring continuously because I know that I'll come to the table fully loaded all the time.
Right, that you're. I imagine that you bring a lot to an audition, JP.
Oh, man, I go in that shit like an idiot, because I know. See, I know the rules of this shit, and I tell any actor out there to do this. You always come in peak. You come in high as and you allow them to turn it. Because everybody knows when someone says pull back a little bit. Everybody knows how to pull back. Nobody knows how to turn it up.
And you weren't first and foremost a writer at the time. I mean, obviously you were a veteran stand-up. You'd written your stand-up.
Yeah, you had done that.
But done you were stuff. Primarily a performer.
Yeah, and I was on the Cedric show. I did his show. So I left a sketch show to go to SNL. So I left on camera, and I had done several other pilots and stand-up stuff, commercials. I had done everything. Coming in there, auditioning for SNL, for me, you know, I'd say, you know what? Let me see what I can do over here. This will be another challenge to see what else I can do in this world as far as sketch comedy. And then when I didn't get the role, the part, they called me and asked me if I want to come in as a writer. And I said, you know what? This will look good on my resume. So I said, what is it to invest a few years, a few seasons on a show like this? And it was an amazing experience because it really is a big machine. But you definitely have to be thick-skinned. You know what it's like? It's like when you're writing a sketch, and it's kind of like you're trying out for the cheerleading team, but you're trying out for that every week.
Yeah, you had a reputation as a committed pitcher, man who would stand up and sell 4 sketch ideas every week.
Every week, four. I would make sure I do 4 a week. And that was, you know, what that is a captive audience. It's an ear to feed. You know, even if I get a smirk out of you on a premise, I know I got your I think about it like this. All that I did on SNL served a purpose. Number one is, I came in as I auditioned for the show. I ended up as a writer on the show. I ended up doing warm-up for 2 seasons. I ended up in crazy monologues. I ended up on the show doing sketches here and there. I ended up doing Conan O'Brien, who was downstairs. That's when he was still with NBC. I must have done Conan O'Brien 10, 11 times while I was working at SNL. They would call upstairs, and Conan would call Lauren and say, hey, can I borrow JB? I got a sketch I'm doing. They would call my office and say, yeah, go downstairs. Conan must use you for a sketch. I would go downstairs. This is a writer on a show. I may have my computer typing jokes. I go downstairs, do Conan, you know, do a sketch on Conan right in front of a live audience, go back upstairs, the same elevator back upstairs, get behind my desk, and finish working.
I want to play a sketch from Saturday Night Live. And really, all you need to know about this is that Snoop Dogg is at a party, and he's not enjoying the party. He seems sad at the party.
Oh, what's up, Snoop?
What's up, Snoop? Man, you enjoying your party?
No, I'm not enjoying my party. Do it look like I'm enjoying my party?
No, it does not look like you are enjoying your party.
Snoop, what's wrong with you?
What's wrong? I tell you what's wrong. The TV show Friends is over, fool. It's the last Friends episode ever. I mean the last one. No more Friends. What the hell am I supposed to do?
I love Snoop.
I mean, you said all this material that no one besides you could sell. I feel like that's something that J.B. Smith could sell or Snoop Dogg could sell, that premise, that silly premise.
Hey, I wrote a sketch. I remember one sketch I wrote when Snoop was a guest. Man, this was, to me, one of the greatest sketches ever that never made it. It was a time of the, it was the same time of the Apprentice. And I wrote a sketch called The Pimptus. So it was Snoop Dogg as a pimp. And all the apprentices was the same as it was set up as just like the TV show, The Apprentice. And I remember when it got cut, all right? And I said, man, I gotta go downstairs and tell Snoop it didn't make it. And I went downstairs, I took the staircase downstairs, and I had to go to his dressing room. I said, Snoop, man, sorry, man, they cut the Apprentice. He said, what? You mean to tell me, J.B. Smoove, they cut the Apprentice? You couldn't believe they cut the Apprentice.
When we return, J.B. Smoove talks about his unforgettable role as Leon on Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace. Squarespace allows small businesses to design and build their own websites using customizable layouts and features including e-commerce functionality and mobile editing. Squarespace also offers built-in search engine optimization to help you develop an online presence. Go to squarespace.com/NPR for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code NPR to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband host, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife host, Teresa McElroy.
And together we present Schmanners.
It's extraordinary etiquette.
For ordinary occasions.
We explain the historical significance of everyday etiquette topics, then answer your questions relating to modern life.
So join us weekly on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
No RSVP required.
Check out Schmanners.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Joining me is actor J.B. Smoove. He's on tour across the country doing stand-up. He's also in the film Spider-Man Far From Home. You may remember him as Leon on Curb Your Enthusiasm. When you auditioned for Curb Your Enthusiasm, mm-hmm. did Larry David know your work at all?
No. I didn't know Larry.
So were you walking in pretty much cold?
I walked in cold as but I know how to audition. But I also thrive on the universe, meaning that Curb Enthusiasm was my favorite show when I was working at SNL. I found it to be amazing. And even at that time, even before I got on SNL, my whole life, my stand-up routine has been a lot of improv. So for me, just knowing that show was improvised blew my mind. I would sit there and watch amazed, like, I can't believe they don't have a script.
So did you go in and audition immediately with Larry David? Because that's my understanding is yeah. that's often how they do it on Curb. They'll yeah. just have
I wasn't
people
supposed,
come in and, yeah. and work with
directly with Larry.
With Larry.
And I always, like I said, my rules are you come, I always walk into the room as the character. I never walk into the room as JB, and I never have to turn on the character I'm auditioning for. If you come in there as a character, they see your mannerisms, they see how he walks in the room, they see what he does with his hands, how he stands, what he, you know, his everything. I gave it to them before I opened my mouth. And I walked up to Larry. Larry's standing in the middle of the room. I had an audition with Larry directly. I said, I might f*** around and slap you in the face. I'm not sure. And I walk away to start the scene, and all I heard was snickering and laughing. And Larry was like, who f*** this guy? You know? And that was the beginning of an amazing relationship between two guys who have never met each other. But I also say that seeds had to be planted. The first thing I ever did before I started doing stand-up was I took an improv course in New York City at the old improv comedy club so I could figure out who I want to be on stage. This is freaking 89, maybe, years ago. First thing I ever did. Put that little tool in my toolbox. Next thing you know, I'm improvising in my stand-up, preparing myself, I guess, for possibly the greatest improvised show on TV.
You play Leon, who's a guy who moved into Larry David's house as a Katrina survivor and just stayed. Now he lives in a pool house, I think, out back.
Yeah, yeah. Doing his thing.
Can you describe to me, because I think one of the very special things about Leon is his manner of dress. It's very different than yours. You came in here in a very nice sport coat. You have on a beautiful pair of boots.
Yes, indeed.
You look like $1 million, JB.
That's what changed.
Leon never looks like $1 million.
Never.
It is a very specific kind of not $1 million that he looks like. Could you describe what he looks like?
I can describe. This guy, he's a guy that lives day to day. His wardrobe matches his confidence. Somehow, this guy wins. He's a winner. And that's what I wanted to come across. I didn't want the guy to come across as a loser. I want him to come across as a dude that's profoundly interesting, eccentric on some levels. How do you get away with wearing this and still have this much confidence in your presence? And, you know, as an actor, I got to choose every scene because, as you know, it's improvised. I got to choose whether I want to have Larry's back or go against him. I got to sit there and think before the scene says action, if I'm going to have his back or if I'm going to go against him. So that means that I got to figure out what's going to get the most mileage of funny and what can I use as a callback later. So in my brain, I got to almost like think about, I got to almost like be a time machine in my brain. I got to see the next episode and the next episode. And I gotta plant something right now that's going to be etched in stone in episode 3 that I can use in episode 5 or episode 8.
Leon reminds me of when I was a kid in the neighborhood. You know, I was born in 1981, so we're probably talking about 1990-ish, 1992, something like that. Dudes who would look like they were auditioning for Saturday Night Fever.
Yes.
And they'd be leading, walking, you know, gangsta lean.
Yes.
The toes coming at you first. And there is this strange combination of, on the one hand, this is 15 years past when that was a cool thing to do. And they are grown adults acting like a 19-year-old.
Oh,
like, on the one hand, it is a terribly, it is like a pathetic and embarrassing thing. But on the other hand, on the right guy, you kind of let it slide.
Yes. Because
you're like, well, he's doing his thing.
He's just out here doing his thing.
And Leon is always just out there doing his thing. If it weren't for the fact that it was so obvious that, you know, Larry and Leon love each other. If it weren't for this romance between the two of them, it could very easily be pathetic, but it's never pathetic because you're just like, wow, he's got these theories, and it's the same thing that draws you to Larry David's character.
Yes,
you know? Larry David's character is a weird crankus.
He's a crankus,
but you love him because he just has a vision for the world.
Yep, and it's so deep how all this works, how you're supposed to end up in these certain places, certain spaces. Before I went in the room, when I walked up there and I walked up to Larry, I felt the energy before we even opened our mouths. I felt like, even in the room, I felt like I knew everybody already. So I think it's one of those things where it goes back to knowing exactly what you're confident in, which is what Leon does, all right? But his mouth, his philosophies have got to overpower that goofy-ass outfit. It has to be a balance there somehow. But when I went in, when I met them, I said, the wardrobe, I said, man, I want the most outrageous you could ever think of. I said, give me some cool tank tops in all colors and flavors. And when I saw that lime green tank top, I'm telling you, that lime green tank tops get so much love. And that robe, the robe with no belt. They gave me the robe with a belt. I said, nah, take that belt out. Throw the belt away. Because I want him to walk around with no belt to the robe. And he's always got to keep holding it shut with his hand. And you would figure, why don't you just get a belt?
I mean, I think, like, I've heard you describe Leon as not right, but also not wrong. And yeah, I think in a way that's true of Larry, too. Like, both of those characters,
yes.
Like, it's really, they both have complicated systems.
Right.
And clear visions of their weird, complicated systems. But ultimately, what is driving each of them is Larry is going to find fault in every social interaction he has,
yes,
no matter
indeed.
What it is.
Yep.
And Leon is going to have an ambitious, positive attitude about every interaction he has with anyone in the world. And the fact that they match so beautifully is a wonderful thing to have happened
to the show.
It really
is, man. It really is. And, you know, I think when you, and even like little things, that choices that you make, even like think about the Seinfeld season, you know, I told the guys before I even did that scene where Larry and Leon are watching the rehearsal of Seinfeld. And I'm saying, I'm gonna pretend Leon never even heard of Seinfeld. And at first I was like, is that too far-fetched? Then I said, nah, it's not. And I played that like I didn't know any of these people on this set. I'd never seen Seinfeld in my life. It gave him this circle, a box to live in, that Larry's trying to get in and learn more about him, and he's trying to get out and learn more about Larry. And I think you always got to create this box that you live in, this world you live in, so that people are always curious to see what makes this dude tick. Like, I love that he doesn't have an origin. You know, he's from L.A., but you still don't know his story. You don't know whether he got thrown out of his old apartment. You don't know anything, but he shows up at your front door and just makes himself at home.
Some of my favorite scenes on the show are scenes where Larry David is just curious about something that Leon thinks or is talking about.
Yes.
You know, like there's a famous scene on the show where your character Leon uses the word lampin'.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Well, lampin'. What you doing?
You're lampin'?
Chillin'. Relaxing.
Why'd you change from chilling? What was wrong with chilling? You got to get another one? Lamping?
Lamping, I can sit around here with boxes on, a tank top, my feet up.
And chilling is what? You got to be in real clothes?
You can walk around and chill. You know, you upright. You chilling upright.
I see. You guys got some great slang.
And so on and so forth. And like on the one hand, you're literally explaining, like, this is slang from a Kool Moe Dee song. This is something from 1988.
Easily, yes. 88.
But because each of you live in these individual magical worlds, and it's so sweet how sincerely curious Larry becomes. The most incurious man in the world. The man who thinks
easily.
He has it all figured out. But this is the one person who's from so far outside that zone.
Yes.
That he's like, oh, what? Tell me about that.
I remember we did a scene, the getting that scene. Larry never heard that phrase ever. You'll see genuine moments of, I can always tell when he really don't know what the I'm talking about. I can tell. His eyebrows get kind of, he starts nodding his head a little bit, and he starts to smirk a little bit. That means he has no idea what the hell Leon is talking about, which I love because it comes across so genuinely, like
it makes it, it really gives the show and the characters levels there. Because you and once you know it's improvised, you're really sitting there watching it like, I don't think Larry knows what getting that is. You know what I mean? But it's such a, you know, it's one of those things where every season I try to introduce something to him that he's never heard of in his life. And it really is, you know, like doing my Dizzle, bringing the ruckus, you know, all those things, all those little nuances, champagne filled croissants, which is silly as hell, but it's silliness, but it all has a meaning.
It's a little bit like if E-40 was a sitcom character.
Right.
Like, let me take you on this flight of fancy. I'm making up words
yes.
and whatnot.
Yes.
I want to thank you for taking all this time to be on Bullseye, JB.
Hey,
it was
man.
Really nice to.
We got
really nice
to do this again sometime. So many little nuances to this world, man. To you know, this journey. I call it a journey, man. Through time and space, man. Through meeting people and building with people, man. And this is building right here.
I bothered you at a party once.
Yeah.
I saw you at a party. I said I was there with no. I didn't know anyone besides the person I came with. I said, "Oh, there goes J.B. Smith." I said, "I'm going to go bother J.B. Smith. I don't have anything else to do at this party. I'm going to bother J.B. Smith. You're very polite to me. I appreciate it.
That's how I do, man. I don't know any other way to carry myself or to live, man. But everybody deserves a little bit of your time, man. A little slice of time, man. And I find it interesting when I meet people, man. It's really, I'm really genuine in that, you know, and I love it, man. And it builds character. It builds your presence, man. Because I always say, man, you gotta leave something. You want some good stories, man, when you leave this earth, man, that people can say, hey, man, one time I met J.B. Smith at a party. You know what I mean? Whatever it is. There's something cool about that, man. Like, God, tell me that J.B. Smooth story again. You know what I mean? Oh, God, I love it.
Thank you, J.B.
My man.
J.B. Smoove, everyone. He is touring our great nation this summer and fall. You can also check him out in the film Spider-Man Far From Home, which is in theaters now. Or maybe take the opportunity to revisit some old episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm. There are a lot of ways to enjoy J.B. Smoove. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is produced at MaximumFun.org, world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where this week our producer Raghu saw a duck walking carefully across a crosswalk like a proper law-abiding pedestrian. Who says no one walks in Los Angeles? The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He's away taking care of a beautiful new baby. So Raghu Manavalan stepped in for him this week. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Thanks to Dan for sharing it with us. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And before you go, did you know Bullseye has nearly two decades of archives available to you? That's right. I started doing this show when I was 19 years old, and I am 38. There are so many great interviews in our archive. You can find them at MaximumFun.org. You can find the last few years' worth on YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can also find them in your favorite podcast app. Hey, how about this? You like Curb Your Enthusiasm? How about Jeff Garland? Jeff Garland's been on the show. That guy's a delight. He plays Jeff on the show. Jeff from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Anyway, that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.